On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. There is no such thing as conversation, wrote Dame Rebecca West once. It is an illusion. There are only intersecting monologues. Essayist Stephen Miller would beg to disagree. Miller has just written a big history of conversation itself, from Plato to Oprah, from the Book of Job to Crossfire. Miller loves great, rich, high-spirited conversation, sees it as essential to full humanity, to mental health, to friendship. And he warns Americans are losing it in a sea of angry barrage and dull confession. Up next on Point, we're headed back to the great age of conversation, to Hume and Swift and Boswell and Dr. Johnson for a pungent take on how we converse today. Joining me now from Washington is Stephen Miller. He's an essayist and writes frequently about 18th century European thought and American intellectual history. His new book, Conversation, A History of a Declining Art, has been called by the eminent literary critic Harold Bloom a celebration and elegy for the art of conversation. Stephen Miller, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
And joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst, himself a magnificent conversant, Jack Beatty. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Now, of course, I'll be tongue-tied. Hello, Tom, and hello, Steve. Nice to have you on the show.
Yeah,
hello, Jack.
Wonderful to have you all. Stephen Miller, I guess we have to ask you right off the bat to define what you mean by great conversation.
Well, great conversation, both David Hume and Samuel Johnson, the key figures in my book, they thought was good-humored disagreement, that if there's no disagreement, it becomes insipid. And the key characteristic of great conversation was raillery, which probably for us would be repartee, a sense of liveliness, and which they felt that was essential.
Good-humored disagreement and raillery. We'll look at that some more. But you also define debate as talk without purpose. Let's see. You're disagreeing, but there's no purpose?
Yes. Well, by talk without purpose, I mean that there. When you go in a conversation, you don't want something from the person you're conversing with. You're not looking to get a job. You're not looking for advice on your marriage. Essential conversations that are the best kind of conversation is purposeless in that sense. Of course, you may have a purpose in the sense that you're discussing a book or a movie, but you don't want something from the person you're conversing with.
This is going to be a challenge, but give us the quick arc of the history of conversation. You start way back. If you have to just draw it in one steady arc on the chalkboard here, how do you describe where it's gone from the days of Plato through your beloved 18th century England to the United States today?
Well, I think most scholars talk about Athens in the classical Greece as a great age of conversation. I talk a little bit about Rome, but then I jump to 18th century England. Now, conversation, the idea of the art of conversation really became important in Renaissance Italy when people thought about what the role the courtier should play and how he could advise the prince. But this is not what I regard as ideal conversation because a courtier, of course, is not on a position of equality with his prince. In any case, some of the ideas from Renaissance Italy then filtered into France and eventually made their way to England. And I call especially the first half of England the age of conversation because almost all the great writers wrote essays about conversation. I'm talking about not only Samuel Johnson and David Hume, but also Henry Fielding, Daniel Defoe. In fact, Defoe wrote a guidebook to England in which he sort of gave ratings to the conversations in different towns in England and Scotland.
That's great. And you remind us that in the coffee shops of England at that time, there was a new kind of equality and freedom. Your big heroes are Hume and Samuel Johnson. How did they exercise that freedom, that new equality?
Well, first of all, the coffee houses in England were unusual because this is a class society. But if you walked into a coffee house in, say, 1710 in London, it didn't really matter which class you belonged to. There was often just a long table, and whatever people were talking about, you could join in the conversation. Often it was about politics because England had the freest press in Europe at the time. Now, Samuel Johnson and David Hume also went to coffee houses. They're a bit later in the century, but they went to clubs, and they valued valued conversation greatly. Hume and Johnson both belonged to a number of clubs and both frequented, especially Johnson, coffee houses.
And paint the picture for us of the kind of ideal conversation that we might have heard in those coffee houses in the time of Hume and Johnson, in contrast to what you perceive as the kind of anemic American conversation today.
Well, it was somewhat the ideal conversation. I don't know if there was an ideal one, because the coffee houses often specialized. So sometimes lawyers went to a certain one, stockbrokers went to another. In fact, one coffee house, which was frequented by people who insured ships, became Lloyd's of London. But so there's a wide variety of conversations in coffee houses. Some of them were very serious. They, in fact, the disciple of Newton used to hold forth in a coffee house. They were kind of penny universities. Some of them were just really for idle gossip. There was a wide range of discussion. We don't really have any record of what they said, except indirectly through Joseph Addison's and Richard Steele's essays in The Spectator. But I would say that it's a fairly confusing situation. It's not like a seminar, but it's very lively and usually a lot of fun.
And the quality of it compared to the quality of conversation you hear in America today, or the qualities, what qualities would you do you hear in your mind's ear, if there's such a thing, we would have heard in those years, and compare it to American conversation now?
Well, I think there's obviously some continuity. People argued about politics, just as they argue about politics now. But there was in Johnson's and Hume's best conversations, I think we can say there was a great deal of good-humored disagreement. Johnson's best friend was Joshua Reynolds. Joshua Reynolds was nominally religious, but never went to church. They usually didn't argue about religion, but they argued about literature, less not so much about politics, about the human condition. There was, I would say, the main characteristic of the good conversations then was this liveliness, this raillery, repartee, wit, and that we find much less of that now because of one, a sort of a fear of offending people, and two, a kind of opinionatedness that comes from the notion of authenticity. So one person gives his opinion, and then another person gives his opinion. So as if one stands in line to give one's opinions.
Authenticity. The Romantics turned us back around toward the individual, Rousseau and all that, and you say out of that, well, in your view, in a way, it was kind of the beginning of the end. Jack Beattie, Stephen Miller quotes the British philosopher Michael Oakeshott, says, conversation distinguishes the human being from the animal and the civilized man from the barbarian. Are we getting brutish, Jack?
Yes, and you know, I have a culprit. And the culprit, as I did an inventory of my declining conversation, I blamed National Public Radio.
Ouch!
Yes, because what does it do, after all? It gives us the model of the interview, the debrief. And I find more and more conversations follow that form. There's a sort of debrief, and then if you're lucky, there's a reciprocal debrief. But of conversation, of the shared world between, of badinage and raillery, no. And then, of course, the other thing the interview does is it gives you the expert, the man or woman who hold forth. And my gosh, are we holding forth today? It seems to me that is a real enemy of conversation, and NPR... Take your responsibility for it.
Jack, in the age of the recently departed Crossfire and Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and all the rest, you're going to pin the blame on NPR.
That's what my ear has been dealing with. No, I mean, it's true. I was listening to Terry Gross the other day, who's wonderful. But I also thought, well, who is she? You know, what's her personality? And you'd never know. There's a line in this book where, you know, Dick Cavett was thinking of starting a talk show, and Jack Parr said, don't make it an interview. Make it a conversation.
And yet there's so much that we want to know about today. I mean, that indictment extends right here, Jack, so we'll take it and we'll pick it up. Stephen Miller, you describe on-air conversations as not for real, as ersatz conversations. Even as I read you, pretty much the best of talk show conversations is not the real deal.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, there are talk shows and talk shows, and I've been on a number of very interesting ones, I have to say. But talk shows are concerned about ratings, so there is an ulterior purpose. It's not as if you're sitting down with your friends, having a nice dinner, and just talking about whatever subject that comes up. In the best conversations in Boswell's Life of Johnson, it's remarkable how they flip from subject to subject, and with some fascinating little takes on this, that, and the other thing. I was looking the other day for an ideal segment from the book, and I came on a conversation that several Johnson, Boswell was there, the writer Oliver Goldsmith, a man named General Oglethorpe, who was the founder of the Savannah, and they started talking about the Chinese eating dogs, and they went on from there to discussing recently a writer who had just died. Then they wanted to talk about the playwright. Then they talk about the role of lawyers in society, and some of this is very witty, as Boswell reports it. You don't have that in an NPR interview, even in the best of them.
I guess maybe next time, Jack, we'll announce this hour we're talking about dog eating, death, playwrights, and lawyers, and we'll see how it goes. It sounds like good fun, actually. We're talking this hour about the art of conversation, from Plato to Oprah, and the state of the American conversation today. The 1981 film My Dinner with Andre, directed by Louis Malle, was kind of held up as a model of wonderful conversation. Let's put some of that in our ear just to listen. Here's a conversation between the actor Wallace Shawn and the theater director Andre Gregory. Just a taste. It turns to the nature of experience and reality.
I mean, because reality is uniform in a way, so that if your perceptions are, I mean, if your own mechanism is operating correctly, it would become irrelevant to go to Mount Everest, and sort of absurd, because, I mean, it just, of course, on some level, I mean, obviously, it's very different from a cigar store on 7th Avenue.
I agree with you, Wally, but the problem is that people can't see the cigar store now. I mean, things don't affect people the way they used to. I mean, it may very well be that 10 years from now, people will pay $10,000 in cash to be castrated just in order to be affected by something.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, why is that? I mean, is it just because people are lazy today, or they're bored? I mean, are we just like bored, spoiled children who've just been lying in the bathtub all day, just playing with their plastic duck, and now they're just thinking, well, what can I do?
Okay, yes. We're bored. We're all bored now. But has it ever occurred to you, Wally, that the process that creates this boredom that we see in the world now...
Okay, there it is. And on it goes, My Dinner with Andre, Louis Malle, 1981. Stephen Miller, is that the real deal?
Well, that's pretty close to it, I think. It's freewheeling. There's no sense of anyone worrying about either one worrying about offending the other person. It has a certain kind of esprit. So I think that's close to conversation, yes.
And Rousseau, you point a big finger at him saying, you know, you messed it up, buddy. Why? How?
Well, Rousseau is in my book a bad guy for a number of reasons, but let me focus on the part of my book. Rousseau intensely disliked the salons in 18th century Paris. His main feeling was that, first of all, they were run by women. He didn't like that. He thought that was emasculating for men to attend a salon run by women.
Tut, tut.
Secondly, he disliked the idea of good humor, frankly. Good humor meaning that one makes an effort to listen to another person and to be polite in one's response. He thought that was somehow inauthentic, that one should express oneself. One should. He's really the first apostle of authenticity. So he thought that the world of conversation, what Hume calls the conversable world, was empty and a fraud, really. It was inauthentic.
And that frame of mind still in effect today. You take it right up to Dick Cheney speaking with Senator Patrick Leahy on the floor of Congress.
Well, yes, I mentioned that...
Maybe that's raillery when you do. Remind us.
No, I put that in my book for a particular reason. I thought that what was interesting was not that Cheney uttered a profanity in the halls of Congress. It was that afterwards, when interviewed about it, he said, yeah, it made me feel good. And I say this is really an idea out of the 60s, or even out of Rousseau, the notion that one expresses oneself and that's good, and it doesn't really matter if it's offensive or stupid or ugly. I felt better about it, so it's okay.
There it is. Stephen Miller, Jack, stand by. I want to invite our callers into this conversation. Jeff's calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you. What do you think?
Well, this is a terrific show, and I can't disagree with what Stephen Miller is saying, but I can't help thinking that he's also pointing the finger at sort of too high. I think the problem is the emptiness and vacuity of the popular culture we're getting, especially from television. I really wish that people were listening to NPR and watching My Dinner with Andre. We'd have much better conversations than we do.
So the popular culture, you point the finger there. Jack Beatty, what do you say? Is this, have the elites let down the standard here? Is the popular culture, eating away, leaving us vacuous? Jeff is worried that's where the culprit is.
Well, I think there's a lot to that. I think that this problem of authenticity, too, is right at the center of it. I mean, that is the modern ethic. And, you know, Boswell's Johnson shows you what's necessary for conversation. Someone like Boswell, a man who, as the Germans say, needed a doppelganger. He needed a double. He needed another identity to bring his out. And his identity consisted in bringing Johnson out. Johnson wasn't just going to come out. He needed Boswell, and conversation needs that. Someone who isn't there just to, you know, express his or her own opinion, but really almost to bring the others out and to orchestrate this thing as an art. And that, I think, is very hard for people today. People say, I just want to be myself. Well, yes, but if everybody's just being themselves in all weathers, you often don't get the common life generated that you get in a conversation where you have someone like Boswell.
Stephen Miller, how do you see this interplay between our individual private conversations and popular culture? One supporting or eating away at the other?
Well, let me just respond to Jack's point, because I second it. One of the things about authenticity that's really bad is that a person who wants to express himself is not really interested in listening to other people. And one of the great things about Boswell is that he was a great listener. He would sort of set up. He would goad Johnson by asking questions that he knew would Johnson would come up with an amusing or interesting or profound answer. So we don't have good listeners anymore. I have to give one example. I was at a dinner party about a month ago, and I mentioned that I just come back from a trip to an interesting city in Eastern Europe. I hadn't been there in 20 years. But so the person sitting next to me said, oh, I was there, too, 20 years ago. And she proceeded to rattle on for half an hour right. about her own rather trivial incident and never asked me a single question about my, you know, 2-week trip there. But that's fairly typical. Maybe she's a little more solipsistic than most people.
This is the travail of all travelers, from what I've seen in life.
Yeah, but
my slides.
Right.
Well, the thing is, she might have learned something. We all will learn something if we were better listeners. But popular culture is somewhat of a culprit here. But I also think it's high culture is somewhat of a culprit in the sense that some of the ideas that come from the '60s, authenticity, also. So this sort of non-judgmentalism that every person's opinion is part of his or her autobiography, and that one responds by saying, "Oh, that's I'm sharing it with you. You're not putting it out there to be attacked in a good-humored way." Those have definitely hurt conversation.
This is the confessional culture that you're so unenamored by. The sort of Oprah talk where it's confession and just nodding along.
Yes, absolutely. And also, in popular culture, I spent about 2 months watching a lot of talk shows. One of the things that's striking about popular culture, at least the talk show on television, is that they really, people go to them because they want, for the most part, they want advice. It's the old expert problem that Jack just mentioned before. They watch Oprah, it seems to me, because they want to be inspired. They want advice about how to lead their lives. Not all talk shows fit that format, but a number do. And I think that's true of American culture in general, that people are impatient with what I call the purposelessness of conversation. They want to be informed, to be edified. They go to lectures about retirement, about how to plan this or that or the other thing.
This has always been the American way in history. Tocqueville and many others, you point out, say Americans don't just want to talk. They want They want a bottom line. They want to come to something, an advantage or some insight, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. I was struck on a website selling my book. The other four books on the website were Crucial Conversations, Talks, Tools for Talking When Stakes Are High, Fierce Conversation. all the books had to do with conversation as a means to getting ahead.
Not to purposelessness. Richard's calling from Boston. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I wondered if your guests were familiar with William Law.
William Law, yes. So that was a profound influence on Samuel Johnson.
Yes, I did my master's on his work. I read all his works at King's Cliff, and I had to contribute his name because he used very artistically and very cleverly the dialogue in his what became bestseller of the 18th century, A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life.
And what did we learn from the tutor of Dr. Johnson, Richard?
Well, he appealed to the ancient Greek Socratic method that truth was the object of a higher knowledge for everybody involved. In other words, there wasn't sort of animosity, competition, contest. It was that everybody had a desire to learn the truth, and that's almost the third person of the conversation. And he'd use names like Theogenes, Theophilus, all these other characters, and he often used women because he was a very close friend with some Hester Gibbons, who was the aunt of Edward Gibbons, the historian. Mm-hmm. And they'd have wonderful conversations because it was a delight in the truth and asking questions and really getting excited about a knowledge of the truth. And, of course, his books, Spirit of Love, Spirit of Prayer, which I highly recommend and I'd love to see them resurface, are a great contribution in theology as well as philosophy and dialogue.
Let me put that to Stephen Miller, if I may, and I'm sorry to step on the end of your sentence there, Richard. But
go ahead.
But Stephen Miller, this comes to the question I'm still a little hung up on the authenticity front. There must be ways to be both civil and authentic in good conversation. We'll turn to that. But what about our caller Richard says, here you've got William Law celebrating the object of truth in conversation. Now, can you have that as an object and still be purposelessness, still have that wonderful kind of freewheeling quality? This is a challenge for us right here. We have a purpose in nearly every conversation. Does that cut us off from good conversation?
No. I have to go back to what I mean by purposelessness. I mean that the people going into the group, they may want truth out of it with a small T or capital T, but they don't want a better job out of it. I belong to a discussion group. We meet once a month. We talk about a variety of things. No one goes to that meeting in order to, improve his, get a better job or for advice about his married life or whatever. So by purposelessness, I mean some ulterior purpose to entering into the talk.
And truth, is that a hidden agenda, a second agenda? Is that too much purpose for you or not?
Well, no, I think it's perfectly fine if people are concerned about looking for truth. Certainly that was what Socrates was looking for in the Platonic dialogues. That doesn't mean that they'll arrive at it at the end. When I analyze the symposium, when you finish reading the symposium, I think a good reader sort of scratches his head and says, well, wait a second, where are we? And then you read it again and it stirs things up. It doesn't necessarily come up with a complete answer.
I know that feeling. Day in and day out. Let me take another call, if I may. Richard, thank you for your call. David's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. How are you today, Tom?
Very well.
I'm a huge fan of your show, so this pains me a little bit, but I think Jack was a little too gentle with you all. One of the symptoms of the problem you're discussing is that no matter how funny or witty or enlightening I am in the next 30 seconds, it's your job to shuffle me off and as fast as possible so that a conversation never really gets to happen. You know, I was sitting actually in Samuel Johnson's seat at the Cheshire Cheese about 2 weeks ago.
Ooh, lucky you.
And I was having a great conversation with all sorts of strangers, including a couple of Englishmen who meet there on a particular night to speak Italian to each other.
Great. Yeah.
And there are parts in the world where you can still find it, but there are a lot of elements that you haven't touched on. You need plenty of time, and people have to come to it with a certain openness, a willingness to change their mind. The way we converse today, it's like everybody shows up for a game of tennis, picks their own backboard, and just hammers away. and, you know, talks over the shoulder. How, are you having a good game? I'm having a good game.
Right. I know exactly. And David, let's stick with this for a little bit. We won't shuffle you straight off here.
Okay.
Because this is something we wrestle with. I mean, you know, you bring up an issue, an important issue of the day. We want to have a good conversation about
right.
it. There are views coming at it from many different angles. And how do you get toward something like a breakthrough? Get everybody in there, hear from the callers.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we should have hours where we just more or less make it coffee house style. Jack, you're my companion here. What do you say? Should we have hours where it's much more loose and free flowing?
It'd be worth the experiment, wouldn't it?
Sounds fun to me.
Yeah, just to see if you could get away from this, if I may say, onanistic quality that David's talking about, where, you know, I'll do mine and you do yours, which is so true. I mean, that's the form that so much conversation takes today, and anything that would break that vice. And you know, truth is important, sure, but boy, I'd hate to go into a conversation thinking, I've got to get some truth. I want laughter.
Yeah,
I want to laugh. And that's what I think conversation can do, that percussive, infectious laughter.
I'm for it. Stephen Miller, give us some advice. And with David with us here, too, when there's a public purpose in the conversation, and very often we have one on this show, we're looking at a particular issue, trying to get to the bottom of it, trying to understand what may lie ahead or why the country or culture has come to the point it's come to. Can you do the sort of freewheeling conversation and get to a public bottom line that matters?
I think that's very difficult. I have to say that Johnson's club, they avoided politics. Johnson's best friend, Edmund Burke, and Johnson totally disagreed in their political views. And having a conversation about politics is difficult, and I wouldn't recommend it right away with strangers. You have to have this basic openness, as the caller said, time, and a sense of what the 18th century writers called politeness, a willingness to listen, a willingness to, even if you strongly disagree with the person, to engage him in a good-humored fashion. This takes a little while to build, and I think all these characteristics are in short supply in the United States, so it is very difficult to have a political conversation.
All right, David, I'm scrunching my face and waiting for your advice. What do you take from all this for one of us poor ersatz conversationalists in talk radio?
Well, the important thing to realize is that conversation is an end in itself. You know, anthropologists think that conversation came before language, that the language actually developed out of grooming behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Conversation is something we do for ourselves and for each other, back and forth. It's part of being a healthy human being. It doesn't matter where the conversation goes. But it's very important to put your own mind on the table. You've got to be willing to entertain a change of your own mind. If you're not, it's like playing with somebody else's money. It's a very, very important thing, but it's not the same as just, NPR and your show is probably the best of the bad.
Stephen Miller holds up one show in the commercial talk arena as maybe not so bad. It's The View on ABC, hosted by five women, including Barbara Walters and Starr Jones. Conversation on the show this morning quickly turned to Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes and their forthcoming childbirth.
By then, he and Katie Holmes will probably have their baby because she is due any day now. He was just interviewed for GQ magazine. He says they're hoping for a quiet birth. You've probably heard a lot about this because he's a Scientologist, and he believes that silence in the delivery rooms is better for mom and baby.
Talk about Mission Impossible.
The three of you are here. All three of you have given birth.
Yes, we have.
Is it possible to do it in complete and utter silence?
If you plug your ears, maybe.
The doctor could be completely silent.
It was when I had the C-section I could have, but when that kid was pushing out the second one, forget it.
But does it affect the rest of your life? Because you know what, I have one of my best friends was actually born in a room, quiet, by candlelight, listening to Teach the Children by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Yeah.
And she is the most peaceful, quiet, relaxed person I have ever met in my life, and I think it has to do with her birthing.
Maybe she's a pothead, right? If she was listening to that.
Exactly.
I mean, that's why she's so peaceful and quiet, right?
I mean, how could it be peaceful and quiet?
Chit-chat, great conversation, raillery, you decide. That's The View this morning. Rich is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Rich, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I would say that an underlying problem with a lack of conversation comes down to value systems. If your value system says that I value your perspective and your right to that perspective, then we can have a great conversation. For example, I would definitely venture to say that I come from a political party that's almost polarized to Jack's regular avowed position. But I love your show because I hear Jack, and I can get his perspective on things, and I think that is a phenomenal benefit to me as a person, and I can value where he's coming from. On
Amen.
The same side, I want to give you credit, Tom, that I see you consistently battling, and I think that as a journalist, you are one of the few exceptions to this rule. You are consistently battling, trying to get both viewpoints, and sometimes even to play the devil's advocate to what I would guess is probably your personal opinion.
But if a moderator is battling, can they be having a good conversation? What do you think, Rich?
Well, I think so. I think that, again, what is your outcome? If your goal is I'm going to convince the world, then that's not really a conversation. If anything, that could even degenerate to a diatribe.
Mm-hmm.
But if your goal is to have your perspective enhanced, enriched, and I value you as a person, whoever it is that I'm speaking to, and vice versa, we can leave that conversation, even disagreeing, saying that's an excellent person and I've benefited from this conversation.
Rich, I love it. Jack Beatty, what about it? The battle and good conversation, can they live together?
You know, one hopes so. And just to hear Rich makes me think it can happen. There's got to be kind of an acceptance, I guess, of you don't have all the answers. And the trouble with our medium is, of course, we're paid to have all the answers.
Well, or at least ask.
Like
at least search for them. You
yeah.
Know,
yeah. And I think that's very hard. But, you know, here's a problem. The older you get, the more you get your views become like a crypt. You're immured in them. You can't get out of them. That's your identity. And it's hard to maintain Rich's openness to other views. And I think I'm going to scratch it down on my paper and say, be open. Because otherwise, you are in danger of just a monologue.
Stephen Miller, you point to something here that may be the bridge out of this polarity that we're stuck in. You say when you come to the conversation with this good humor, a kind of civility, just manners or politeness, it opens up a space where maybe that kind of openness can occur rather than just gripping the poles. Is this in a roundabout way or maybe quite direct an answer to our political sort of standoff these days?
Well, I do think that everyone in the 18th century said you had to have a politeness. You really couldn't have a conversation if you just say, this is my opinion. Do you have a problem with that? And that's what a lot of people will do nowadays. But also there's a kind of, intellectual poverty. People are stuck in their own, what I call in my book, anger communities, and that and they don't really talk to people outside of, or rarely talk to people outside of this community. So they don't even entertain ideas. I have to give an anecdote that I didn't plan to give, but it's good. So in the early 1980s, I was at a dinner party in New York with very liberals, and I announced at the party that I had voted for Ronald Reagan. Well, there was total silence. No one said to me why. They just changed the subject. The feeling was that, well, he's got this bizarre, unthinkable position. He's a nice guy. He's seemingly intelligent. So we'll just change the subject. And I think that's true to a great deal of political discussion these days. It's unfortunate.
Well, a couple of
but
things.
I want to say one
yeah,
more
yeah,
thing.
Yes,
my book isn't about just political discussion.
Mm-hmm. Clearly not. And I love, I mean, but when you talk about anger, you've got some wonderful people. You look, quoting Deborah Tannen here, saying, quite seriously, our spirits are corroded by living in an atmosphere of unrelenting contention and argument culture. We're hearing that. Plutarch, quoting Sappho, when anger takes over your heart, guard your babbling tongue. And then this one, Jack, to your point about humor, Stephen Miller quotes Plutarch saying, anger is worse than undiluted wine at producing undisciplined and disagreeable results. Wine's results are blended with laughter, jokes, and singing. Anger's results are blended with bitter gall. That's not the drink we're looking for in our coffee house, Jack.
No, we want some of that spritz. And it's very hard to do that if you take yourself and your views too seriously. You've got to have a certain distance from it. And, you know, the 18th century, it was the century of public man. I mean, people had public characters that they were going to maintain. And and of course the sincerity revolution and the authenticity revolution and so on has undermined that. But there's a lot to that. To have a public character, which means I'm going to be somewhat detached from my own views, and in that way you can actually have some play.
But Stephen Mill, let me ask you about this. A couple of things really caught my eye as you wrote. I mean, one just interesting. You say you very much approved of a friend of yours was at a dinner party. The hostess said, "Wars are always wrong and that we should have negotiated with Hitler." At that point, your friend turned to his wife and calmly said, "I think it's time for us to leave." You applaud this. And let me ask you, that's an extreme example, but interesting. Then you say, "I would have no trouble continuing a conversation with someone who is deeply religious, so long as he or she was not a zealot who believed in biblical inerrancy." And we've got a lot of people in this country today who believe in biblical inerrancy. Are you really suggesting we should not have conversations with them?
Well, I think we should, but it's very, very difficult. Both Johnson was deeply religious, and so was a writer he greatly admired, Joseph Addison. But they really worried about religious zealotry and basically argued that you can't have a conversation once you start injecting the Bible. And in Johnson's essays, he avoids, by and large, biblical allusions. Zealotry was an enemy of politeness. And so I think it is. I had this experience myself about 6 months ago where I came upon a couple that actually I was talking about in my book and I made them so important. And they said, "Well, that's if you believe in evolution." And, you know, my jaw dropped. I didn't know where to proceed from that. And I did. I didn't leave the room. I stayed there for it was a dinner party. And I tried to have a conversation with this couple, but it really didn't work.
But there's the national circumstance. I mean, that's another challenge, Jack, that we face right here, is to have a conversation that surmounts or encompasses the whole range of views. And it's enormous today. And to do it with good humor, but it does get challenging sometimes.
It does. Ortega y Gasset says that tolerance is the acrobatic willingness to share existence with another. Acrobatic, because you've got to keep leaping over your own principles. And I think Rich gives us the clue. You know, I mean, when he says, you know, you've got to respect the other person. You can't say that their ideas are motivated by some other agenda or that they're wrong in any moral way. That's the other thing. Especially persons on the left are very want to say the persons on the right are immoral. You know, because,
and vice versa,
and
certainly.
Vice versa. And that's just that kills conversation completely. People can be wrong on facts, but please don't impugn their motives.
Ellen's calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm sorry to bring the level of conversation down a bit by talking about women versus men in conversation.
Why not? Let's go.
Pardon me?
Why not? Let's go there.
Okay, well, it was a more lofty conversation you were discussing. But
I don't know. Let's get down and dirty.
Okay, well, there is, I think, a difference between the way men and women talk to one another, and I think women can always converse. There's always something a woman can talk about with another woman, and you can always feel as though you have a good conversation, although I have to admit, more and more today, I find women sort of just talking through you instead of talking with you. But I think there is a difference, and particularly with children, women with children can discuss their children ad infinitum, whereas men tend to talk about, I mean, not just on sexist, tend to talk about things that are more general and not very specific about their children, if they talk about their children at all. I don't know how you feel about that, if you feel that to be the case, or I don't know if you sit and chat about your children.
I absolutely do. But what about the view that we heard at the top of this segment? It's earthy, a little sublime. Is that the female capacity on television display to your ear, Ellen?
Yes, I would say that women have a sort of patois. They're able to talk with one another at a very basic level. There's often not a need to discuss lofty things like Samuel Johnson or Edmund Burke or people of that ilk. I think women, I mean, certainly there is a place to discuss politics, especially George Bush today, but I don't find that women need that as much to have a good conversation. You can just talk about anything, really.
Of course, the basic and the lofty live pretty close to one another very often. Stephen Miller, what about it? You look at the history of conversation. Well, it seems an odd question even to ask, yet you address it, women and conversation and how that relationship's been seen through time.
Yes, well, it was a big debate in the 18th century because some writers thought women really didn't have the intellectual clout to be in a conversation, notably the Earl of Shaftesbury. Johnson and Hume disagreed. In fact, Hume greatly admired the number of French salonnières, the women who led the French salons. Now, as far as topics of conversation go, your caller mentioned that why talk only about Samuel Johnson, or why can't men maybe talk about, less exalted subjects. Well, I think the best conversations really go far and wide over a wide range of topics, from intellectual to the trivial. And why even put labels on it? Samuel Johnson's conversations in the life of Johnson are all over the place.
Virginia Woolf, no mean intellectual, as you report, said, "Let's talk about sex."
Oh, she absolutely. Also, gossip. There's a wonderful essay about she wrote in which she describes a salon in London where it's only gossip. If you say anything serious, you're kicked out. It sounds like it's a wonderful little piece, and you don't see this side of Virginia Woolf in the movie representation of her. But she was reputed to be a great conversationalist.
Ellen, we'd love to have it with you. Thanks for calling. Marcus is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Marcus. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having my call.
Certainly.
I grew up in England, and I spent most of my life, however, in America, so I have that kind of perspective.
Yes.
And it seems that what you're talking about and what NPR does so well is argumentation back and forth through perspectives, whereas I think when I grew up in England, one of the pervasive things I learned, I didn't realize I was learning it, was a sense of irony. That it's not that important. Your perspective on life is not that important. But in America, a lot of people, most people think their point of view is important, and they want to convince their neighbor or whoever it is they're talking about, child rearing or politics or whatever, that it really is important. So there's a tension that happens, whereas with irony, maybe even verging on skepticism, maybe verging on cynicism, you can kind of get that edge out of it.
Yes, Marcus, I know exactly what you mean. I love that quality in conversation with friends in the UK, but isn't that kind of the essence of the difference? Isn't that what America is, that sincerity of belief?
Right, and saying, well, America's behind and so on and so forth. How do we, quote-unquote, change that? And I'm saying, it's so fundamental, this perspective of it's not that important, and America is still empire building, and England is kind of over that phase.
There's the word from across the Atlantic. Marcus, your phone sounds like it's from wherever Marcuse first broadcast from, but we're delighted to hear from you. Stephen Miller, what about it? Is irony necessary? Is the American heart too full of sincerity, even passions, to go there? Can you have great conversation if it's not ironic, skeptical, cynical?
Well, no, I think you need some of those qualities. I don't know which order. Tocqueville made the same point as your caller did. He said that Americans tend to be terribly serious, and they tend to lecture you rather than converse with you. So this has been an ongoing problem. I think the 18th century term of politeness encompassed these notions of humility, skepticism. Samuel Johnson liked good conversation so much that David Garrick said that, look at Johnson. Which side is he going to take on this question? Because he wanted good humor disagreement. He thought it was very boring to just everybody sit around agreeing. We have the idea of Johnson as being this sort of Tory dogmatic, but it's really, I think, it's sort of a very partial portrait of him.
Good for Johnson, Jack. But here we are. We're at war. We've got, all kinds of oil. We've got real problems here. Can we really just have delightful conversation and get two answers? Or maybe that's the way untaken.
Yes, maybe it is, and maybe that's the way to sanity. I mean, I think that there is a connection between conversation and sanity. It leavens these harsh things. It makes things seem bearable. You laugh unexpectedly. Life is in front of you. It's happening. Things aren't frozen. And I really do think there's such a connection between sociability, conversation, and just holding on to your sanity.
Sanity, that's a word, a good word to go out on. Bubbling, sparkling, irreverent, ironic, cynical, if you will, but give us sanity. Stephen Miller, you've really brought us a nice portion of that. I hope you'll come back and speak with us again. We'll have another conversation.
It will be my pleasure.
Stephen Miller, essayist and author of the new book, Conversation, A History of a Declining Art. Jack, wonderful to have you as always. Thanks for your scintillating contributions, my friend.
Thank you.
I say without prejudice or anger, full of joy and exuberant, yeah, blah, and on we go. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, download the On Point podcast, or subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.